Robin, I'm going to turn the program over to you.
All right, thank you. Hold on to what is good, even if it is a handful of earth. Hold on to what you believe, even if it is a tree which stands by itself. Hold on to what you must do, even if it is a long way from here. Hold on to my hand, even when I have gone away from you. So as we've been reminded, there are many somber things from the pandemic to this new war. But one thing that's important in the face of that is coming together in community. I want to thank everybody for that. Now, I'm not an expert in this field, and actually I'm never an expert in the topics I talk about, but often I'm the only person in the room who's heard of the subject and read a couple of books. But in this case, I do not have a background in psychology or philosophy or counseling, and I've actually been fortunate enough to have relatively few personal experiences of grief in my life. So I'm going to give some short remarks and hope to hear from many of you. I actually started talking about this topic way before the pandemic. Since I'm going to be 70 this year, I found myself attending more memorials and funeral services than I used to. We had a period in 2019 when Prairie UU lost three members in about a month. And I know your group had a similar thing. You had three or four members within a short time that you lost. And so some of the services are celebrations of life, stories about the deceased, songs, pictures, but many are traditional Christian services. And I found myself thinking, Christianity cheats. They say the person isn't really dead. You'll see them again and so on. Now, I can understand it's a comforting thought. The same idea comes up with the image of the rainbow bridge where all your deceased pets are healthy and romping about, and someday they'll be thrilled to reunite with you. I can't help having the cynical thought that people like my animal-loving sister-in-law would be surrounded by an entire pack of animals. But in any case, sometimes the traditional ideas of heaven are not helpful or are hurtful to those of us without orthodox beliefs. So I had this idea, but then when grief was everywhere, I actually put it off. It's the last thing I wanted to think about. Some of you know that my daughter, who is now 42, has been living with cancer for over 2 years. She is doing well in that she's been able to keep this at a low level and continue working and living, but she had to take many extra precautions during the pandemic. Her response to the situation after the first diagnosis was to do a lot of research and ask the doctors many questions. And I took the other tack. I've avoided this information as much as possible because statistically it wasn't great. And I can't even read fiction books where characters have cancer. And I also have the totally irrational and superstitious view that because I decided to give this program today, it was on Friday that we learned that her latest medication she was taking to avoid more rounds of chemo is not having the desired effects, so additional steps will be needed. Now, I know this really has nothing to do with anything I decide, but it just shows how easy it is for us to jump to all kinds of thoughts. Well, today I'm going to talk about two related topics. One is dealing with our own death, and one is dealing with grief from losses of others. The first book, and these are both specifically books that do not take traditional religious approaches. The first book is by a psychotherapist named Irvin Yalom, Y-A-L-O-M. It's called Staring at the Sun, Overcoming the Dread of Death. The title comes from a quote by La Rochefoucauld. Le soleil ni la mort ne se peuvent regarder en face. That is, you cannot stare directly at the sun or at death. Dr. Yalom comes from a Jewish tradition, but he said even when he was young and would go to synagogue on the high holy days, he writes, I felt totally bewildered that the congregation paid homage to a deity so cruel, vain, vengeful, jealous, and thirsty for praise. He says, I do not doubt that religious belief tempers the death fears of many, yet to me it begs the question. It seems like an end run around death. And he says, death anxiety is the mother of all religions, which in one way or another attempt to temper the anguish of our fortitude. God softens the pain of mortality through some vision of everlasting life and palliates fearful isolation by offering an eternal presence. Well, if we don't find that comforting, why should we think about death at all? Yalom says, I feel strongly that confronting death allows us not to open some Pandora's box, but to re-enter life in a richer, more compassionate manner. Death awareness may serve as an awakening experience, a profoundly useful catalyst for major life changes. So we see this in A Christmas Carol and its modern equivalent, It's a Wonderful Life. You have someone who sees a vision of their upcoming death and realizes that they have a chance to do things differently. Many people report this feeling if they survived a health scare or a car crash, for instance. It could even be reaching a milestone birthday such as 50, 60, or 70. And that's why some ancient philosophers recommended keeping a skull on one's table to remind us of our mortality and therefore the importance of valuing life and using it well. And this is what you have on the front of the playbill, Epicurus. Death does not concern us, because as long as we exist, death is not here. And when it does come, we no longer exist. So this is the Greek philosophers looking at death. And also as a way to appreciate life. So what I saw when I was dealing with this first news about my daughter was that I somehow had this myth that nothing would really happen in my family. And that was a myth, because at any time something could happen, as so many people saw in the last 2 years. Now, as a psychotherapist, Yalom has found several ways in which fear of death shows up in his patients. I think it's normal for some of us to have the extreme FOMO, F-O-M-O, which is fear of missing out. You really want to see how your grandchildren will grow up. I feel that our country and the world are in a very dangerous period, and I may not be around long enough to see the pendulum swing another way. I'm very curious to see how we will be perceived in the future. But that's not an existential worry. The fear of death can express itself as concern for how our family and others will cope without us, and sometimes that reflects a belief that our children are our legacy and their success or failure comes directly from us. Of course, we never really have control of how others will live. Yalom introduces us to a bigger concept of rippling. Actions we take have an effect in the world, much of which we will never know. And these are also our legacy. It could be tangible gifts such as donating organs or all our contributions to communities in the world. Something you said once that put somebody on a different path. Another common issue in fear of death is the sense of an unlived life. I haven't accomplished what I wanted to. Well, it might be important to look and see, is that really what you wanted? Money, marriage, accomplishments? Was that what you were conditioned to want? Or if it's clear that you wanted a life you don't have, regret can be a positive thing, a catalyst to remind you that it's never too late. There could be an alternative. A 60-year-old can't be a Major League Baseball player, but maybe you could coach local young people. During the pandemic, many people changed or quit jobs because they realized that at any time, their time could be up. And is this how they really wanted to spend their energy? Yalom states, the way to value life, the way to feel compassion for others, the way to love anything with the greatest depth is to be aware that these experiences are destined to be lost. All we really have ever is now. And to go back to Epicurus, he talks about this idea that there's a long timeline. There were millennia without us. Then we were a little blip. And there are millennia after us. For some reason, we don't seem as disturbed by the time before us, and yet it is the same thing. And as free thinkers, we aren't worried about punishment after death. As respecters of science, we know that our molecules will go somewhere into the soil or the air and continue to be part of the universe. And in an emotional sense, we will be remembered by those around us or by what we leave behind. In our society, aging and death are usually hidden or considered a failure. We might have fears around the whole process, becoming isolated, becoming dependent on others, of pain, of no longer being able to participate, feeling useless. And unfortunately, unlike some cultures, ours does not generally honor older members of society. But the best way to overcome all this, according to Yalom, is to make connections. Talk honestly about your concerns, share your life with others. We often don't want to burden others, but opening real conversations is a contribution to everyone. Another practice he recommends is the gratitude visit. Think of someone still living toward whom you feel gratitude that you have never really expressed. Write a letter expressing your gratitude. Then arrange to visit and read that letter in person. If that's really not feasible, you could do this by a phone call. And the final statement in Dr. Yalom's book is, I do not intend this to be a somber book. Instead, it is my hope that by grasping, really grasping our human condition, our brief time in the light, we will come not only to savor the preciousness of each moment and the pleasure of sheer being, but to increase our compassion for ourselves and for all other human beings. But let us shift gears. Unless we have an ongoing health crisis, most of us will only deal with our own death over a relatively short period of time. However, all of us have multiple opportunities to deal with grief. And times of grief can include losses of all sorts, loss of a job, loss of an opportunity. My husband, before the pandemic, sang in 4 choirs. All their in-person activity has been stopped for 2 years, and this is a big loss. Well, right now we're going to look at grief specific to losing someone important in your life. There's a very short book called On Death, Dying, and Disbelief by a woman named Candace R.M. Gorham, who is a counselor. She wrote it in 2021, so it's very recent. And it came out of her own deep grief at the loss of a loved one. Her roots, she's a Black woman, and her roots are in the Christian church. She felt the need for other approaches than those of her church-going friends. She calls herself a non-theist because she feels the terms atheist and agnostic have too much baggage. And that's a great thing about the term freethinker. You get to define it. Of course, there is an entire industry of books, seminars, and support groups on dealing with grief, some more secular than others. But Gorham felt there was little that was specifically intended for those without a traditional religious framework, especially in the face of the pandemic. Well, one of her suggestions is to do something in honor of the deceased person, and she took on writing this book in memory of someone who had always supported her work. Gorham says that non-theists are sometimes hard on ourselves when we find ourselves thinking of the loved one as existing somewhere else or talking to them. But this is perfectly normal. Now, we all know about the 5 stages of grief. And many of us know now that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who first described them, never meant them as a blueprint to be followed in a clear ascending order: denial, anger. But there's no smooth progression from one to another. We had someone speak on grief a few years ago at Prairie, and people think that perhaps your recovery from grief would be a steady climb, when really it's all full of loops and back and forth. There is no right way or schedule of grief. Something suddenly may happen. There might be an anniversary or a birthday, and suddenly you're plunged into an emotional maelstrom. You hear a song or taste of food, or you're handling everything well. Something totally unrelated happens, like you get a flat tire and you totally fall apart. These are all normal. And even the stage of denial can come back. Sometime after my father had passed away, I found myself thinking, oh, I should tell my dad about this, and then realizing I couldn't. And denial, in a way, protects us. My parents were both living on the East Coast at the time they passed away, and I wasn't used to seeing them every day, so it took me a while to realize they weren't still there. Now, the stage of anger often manifests in believers being angry with God. As non-believers, we don't have that, but we might be angry at other people telling us that death was God's will or that the person is in a better place. Gorham reminds us there are no bad emotions. It is normal to be angry. We might have specific grievances about the person's behavior. They shouldn't have smoked, or the medical establishment. They should have caught this sooner and handled it better. Gorham writes, unless you are surrounded by non-theists, you will most likely have to deal with some spiritual people during your time of mourning. One thing about death that I find the most frustrating is attending Christian funerals. I quickly grow tired of listening to preaching about heaven and angels. It especially gets under my skin when those conducting the service say that God took the person for a reason, a higher purpose that has not been revealed to us. I get angry when a preacher says a baby got their wings. What we need to remember is that the funeral is comforting to those who are spiritual. The funeral is a ritual for the living. And she notes that if you set aside the religious aspect, funerals accomplish the same tasks that she recommends for the rest of us: being in community, honoring the deceased, connecting with nature through burial or scattering of ashes. So she discourages us from speaking out, for instance, to state that the deceased didn't share these Christian beliefs. We can be generous and let others use rituals that are useful to them. And it's up to you how much you want to explain to others what sort of comfort you welcome. As in all cases, it's best to assume that people have good intentions when they offer to pray for you, for instance, although that may not be something that you would take on yourself. Candace Gorham gives a lot of specific advice for the grieving. Take care of yourself. Your loved one would want you to be safe and healthy. Prioritize getting rest, meals, and exercise. Get out into nature as much as possible. Connect with other people, even if you don't feel like it. But you don't have to force yourself to do things you really don't want to do, like go to a large social event. Sometimes we do go out and suddenly realize we're having fun and laughing, and then we feel guilty. Gorham reminds us there's plenty of time for grief. You can still have enjoyment in your life. At bottom, grieving is a lonely process. She says, either it seems like no one understands, or I worry that people are tired of me talking about my loss. These are very common sentiments. Every person I know who has ever suffered a profound loss has told me they had the same persistent thoughts and worries. This is where a professional therapist can step in, as it is their job to listen to you. Grief can manifest in depression, having trouble getting up and doing anything in the day, or anxiety, constant worry about what other bad things can happen. A common expectation in our society is you should work through grief within a certain period of time. We're lucky to get 3 days off work for a funeral. And after a couple of months, people may begin to state that you need to move on. What does that even mean? Does it mean to stop talking about the person? To dispose of their personal items? To find new people to take their place? That's impossible, of course. Be forgiving of yourself. Give yourself the time and space you need. Maybe start small. Instead of going on a long trip, go away for a day. Do not obligate yourself to take on huge changes. All grief counseling recommends you postpone major decisions. Your brain is preoccupied and your main work is healing. For instance, you might suddenly decide to move far away to avoid memories of the loved one. But when you are then ready to get out into the world, you're in a town where you have no contacts or support system. If you do need to make important decisions, seek out a trusted friend or family member to consult with. As non-theists, we may recoil at the thought of a grave site or a home altar, but we can create these things in our own fashion. Maybe you would like to go to a place your loved one favored and remember times you spent there. Maybe you would like to put up in your home things that relate to the deceased. For instance, if the person loved cats, a picture or a small model of a cat might be a way to remember. You could plant flowers or a tree as a living memorial. Gorham happens to be a big crier, and she describes the physical benefits of crying. Again, our society is not really comfortable with public tears. Sometimes I've seen in the news when there's a tragedy somewhere in the world, where people in Africa or Asia, people are screaming and yelling and pulling at their hair. And I sometimes wish we could do that more. The end of this short book describes how to support other people going through grief in very practical ways. For instance, if you deliver food, don't expect the grieving person to wash and return a container to you. And on a more holistic level, she states, grief is hard, both for the one in mourning and for those trying to support them. You might get exhausted too. Accepting that they have to go through a unique, individualized process allows you to focus your efforts on concrete, helpful actions that require little or no input from them. And in closing, before I hear from some of you, I'd like to mention a couple things. Our friend Bob Park recommends a website called Grief Beyond Belief. It has short articles on everything from children and grief to dealing with holidays to grief memes. It has a science and research section. There's an interesting article there that found that non-theists often dealt better with grief than believers because they did not have the cognitive dissonance of having to explain why a loving God would cause or allow this death. They did not go through a phase of being angry with or doubting toward a religion or a deity that they had been taught to revere. Non-theists were more likely to use the experience for what is called post-traumatic growth and less likely to experience what's called complicated grief with debilitating symptoms. This doesn't mean that we are less affected by trauma, loss, and grief, but we don't have an additional burden of forcing our reactions to conform to inherited views of life and death. And then the last thing is, because great minds think alike, our Prairie minister, Reverend Matt Aspen, is actually speaking today about grief to our congregation. That will be available on the Prairie website within a couple of days. And I plan to listen to that and would recommend it to anyone. So again, this is an area where I have very little expertise, and I would love to hear from people about any personal experiences or inputs you would like to give or comments in general. And oh, one thing that I wanted to mention about bringing this up is that it seemed important to a lot of us to not step over grief and say, oh, things are better now, just forget about it. Yeah, just to point out, there are some specific things we can do. With anything that seems to be bothering us, it's helpful to start doing something. Many of us, when we were younger, were not interested in our parents' and grandparents' stories, and now we are, and it's too late. So if you have family members, and also for yourself now to record, Carl has written a book, a memoir, but yeah. If you want to record or write up anything, it does not have to be a great work of literature. Or if you have other relatives where this has not been done, this could be very valuable. And then in more very practical terms, we can put in place things like medical power of attorney or what's a will or other things that we want. Even what you want at your memorial service, Delita Chaprue from Prairie passed away rather suddenly, but she had had a little bit of warning. And it was actually helpful that she had been very specific about which of her musical groups she wanted to perform. And those people felt honored to be asked by her. So there are things that can be done. We tend to avoid them because who wants to think about that? But it could be a gift to the people that have to arrange this afterwards. And of course, a tragic thing about COVID was that people could not physically gather and also that they could not be with their loved ones often when they were dying, which is a really stressful thing. And then so stressful for the medical establishment, which is used to having some people die, but not multiple people every day in this terrible way. And it's difficult either way. If something happens suddenly and you don't get to even see the person, that can have its difficulties. Both my parents went quickly in different ways, and that was actually a gift to me because I didn't have to make a lot of decisions about treatment. And we saw, on the other hand, my father-in-law who had dementia, and it was like losing him over and over again. So there is no good way really for this to happen. And I've learned from everyone. It's a good comment that grief can reflect what kind of relationship we had with that person. That might be something to look at. Are there people where if they died suddenly, you would feel that, oh, I should have said something or done something? Well, we still have a chance. So thank you, everybody, for participating.